Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm sort of not quite ready for the start of campaign season, but aside from that, everything is fine.
Want to ask me how I am?
How are you, Bob?
I'm suffused in shame. You know why?
I can think of so many reasons.
Well, give me one.
Wrong.
You
suckered all sorts of people to participate in Blogging Heads for free, and, you know, they're not getting their money's worth.
That's a source of deep pride. No, shame, I said. Shame.
Okay.
I'm suffused in shame because I'm surrounded by green. Do you remember last week's bold prediction?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering what was going to happen with that.
I guess I miscalculated. I had claimed that finally we were on the verge of launching the redesign, and I boldly predicted that next time you and I showed up, the redesign would be up. And I don't know what to say except that errors were made in judgment.
Yeah.
But now what worries? I do think now we're so close that I'm almost worried that
the green will disappear halfway through this dialogue.
No, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried that it maybe will launch before you and I next dialogue, so you won't be around to, you know, crash the metaphorical champagne bottle against the metaphorical hull of the metaphorical redesign.
Well, that's okay, Bob. I used to be important to Blogging Heads, but now I'm just one of thousands of people you've invited to the party.
Now, Mickey, you'll always be special.
So it doesn't bother me.
You'll always be special.
I was wiping a tear from my eye. Okay.
I didn't say whether you'd be special in a good way or special in a bad way, but...
Why, so what? So I don't break the champagne bottle.
You didn't say whether it was a tear of joy or a tear of sorrow either.
You've built this vast Blogging Heads bureaucracy. I don't get communications from Bob Wright anymore. Oh, no, he's too big. I don't think I even get communications from our tech guy. I get communications from
Hey, Mickey, why weren't you at our gala Hollywood party the other night?
The tech guy's tech guy. You didn't have a gala Hollywood party.
No, it's just that you weren't invited. Only kidding. We didn't have one.
There's always a party that one's not invited to.
You're telling me.
Okay.
So anyway, I'll talk a little more about the redesign maybe toward the end when we have our celebrated and widely enjoyed comments on the comments.
I hate that section.
Yeah, I know you do.
Because I've never read the comments except for Googling for my name to figure out how many.
I know, and the commenters know that, and they resent you for it. You act as if you're above them.
No. There's plenty of things on the web that I...
You act as if it's like at that Atlantic party we discussed last time, and you're up on stage, and they're, you know, in the seats.
They're putting on a better show than we are.
Some would say. Or would if anybody handed them a camera.
Somebody might.
Somebody might. So is it, this is going to air on Monday. Is it too late to discuss the Annapolis conference of what will have been 6 days earlier?
I don't think so, because now we
have
the perspective of half of those 6 days. David Ignatius wrote a column where he basically said, despite all the derisive commentary, that it's basically a step in the right direction. I don't see any reason to contradict him.
I haven't seen that column, but I was actually surprised by the amount of commentary in the aftermath of it that was something other than dismissive. Tom Friedman wrote a non-dismissive column.
Because you favor being dismissive?
Well, I just that had been the mood prior to the conference, and there are certainly, you know, grounds for it. I mean, as everyone has said, both leaders are in a very weak position, and I mean not to kvetch about Bush or anything, but I didn't think he helped things along in that regard a whole lot, because, you know, he gave this speech where he didn't say much of anything, but the one thing he did say I would think would have tended to undermine support for Abbas, and Abbas is in even weaker position than Olmert right now. Bush made no significant comment at all, except for one, and that was to, according to the story by Helene Cooper in the New York Times, at least, was to say that he's against the right of return for Palestinian refugees. And of course, That is, that means, in other words, the right of, after a settlement, the residents of Israel proper before 1947 or whatever to return, and maybe some of their descendants or something, to Israel proper. And, of course, that is something that everybody agrees is going to have to be compromised by the Palestinians in the end. But for Bush to say that now, just it seems to makes it a little harder on it. For Abbas to come and be identified with a president who dismisses, you know, a goal that is really important symbolically, at least to a lot of Palestinian people right now. I didn't understand, you know, why he did that.
I thought there were two big concessions Israel made. One is they put Jerusalem on the table, in addition to the right of return.
Yeah, but even Bush didn't do that or affirm that.
I mean, thought it's in the document. There was a document that came out of this conference, a new roadmap.
Well, Olmert had done that in advance, in a sense, by saying that parts of annexed East Jerusalem really probably shouldn't be annexed.
Well, maybe this is the payback for that. You don't know how these things work. Secondly, that we would be the arbiters of whether the roadmap was being adhered to, not Israel. I don't quite know what that means, since if Israel says, oh, no, we think we're adhering to the roadmap, it seems to me progress stops. But those were held out as the two concessions, and so it's wrong to say that there were no anti-Israel aspects to it.
Yeah, I guess I just mean in Bush's speech itself, in terms of things he said that weren't scripted that everybody didn't know were going to happen.
Right.
But the other thing is just Gaza, and I don't even understand. It's kind of, Abbas does not even in any meaningful sense govern Gaza right now, so I don't know what's going to. It's not clear to me whether some people are essentially thinking of basically a separate peace involving just the West Bank, because he certainly can't speak for Gaza. So that's one reason to be skeptical. The other reason to be skeptical is that in that context, you would think that Hamas has a reason to want to undermine the talks. And it's clear the way they would do that, they would initiate violence and Israel would retaliate and some civilians would get killed accidentally, and enough of that happens, and we've seen this story before.
Right. But if you want a peace process, that's what's going to happen. I mean, Hamas is always going to try to undermine it.
Here we get back to some mistakes that I think were made earlier in trying to isolate Hamas, rather than make it part of the process.
Everything would have worked out if we'd all followed your advice. But it does seem to me that isn't there a possibility for a positive dynamic? And if Hamas and Fatah are competing for the sort of affections of the Palestinian people, Abbas and Fatah's comparative advantages. Striking a peace deal with Israel, establishing an independent state, and saying, look, Hamas, you're sitting there blowing people up. We are now have a our own state with our own government, and we are prospering, and you're sitting there in Gaza stewing in poverty. It seems to me that is a potentially good dynamic.
Well, that's why Hamas would want to undermine the process, and it seems to me they shouldn't have a whole lot of trouble doing that if they really want to.
It means the dynamic is better with the two groups each in charge of their own territory than if they're mixed together fighting in one territory. Does Hamas have a presence in the non-Gaza West Bank part?
Well, it has enough of a following, and Fatah has a following in Gaza, so
yeah.
it's not as clear cut
as I'm saying.
Yeah. There's a struggle for support in both areas.
The other dynamic at the talks was the prospect of flipping Syria into an anti-Iranian posture, which apparently Condoleezza Rice sort of hinted at on an airplane interview with David Brooks. And it's weird. Fred Kaplan has this piece in Slate about how we missed an opportunity to start this, a year ago. During the war in Lebanon against Hezbollah, when Hezbollah attacked Israel, there was a brief possibility of somehow, and the Saudis issued a statement condemning Hezbollah. There was a sort of an opportunity to seize on that as a sort of basis for some sort of you know, support by the Saudis for broader peace talks. I don't quite know how that happened. Dennis Ross apparently urged that Bush do that, and he knows more about the region than I do. So if he said that, that probably is a missed opportunity. But the thing I didn't understand is why Syria would join in an anti-Hezbollah United Arab Front, since isn't Syria sort of vaguely allied with Hezbollah, or am I completely wrong?
You said United Anti-Arab?
Anti-Hezbollah.
Oh, anti-Hezbollah. Well, yeah, they're playing ball with Hezbollah in Iran right now, and I guess you can imagine various reasons. One is they'd like the Golan Heights back, I guess,
right.
Although they kind of like it as an issue, probably. They are Arabs. Iranians are not, so there's that cultural fissure
right.
to play on. And you would throw in other inducements.
Saudi patronage, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, well, and America. I mean, two countries that have money are Saudi Arabia and America. And I guess it is good news that Saudi Arabia and Syria were represented at the conference. In fact, somebody pointed out that maybe it wasn't such a good idea that 7 jillion other nations were as well, that they would have been better off to highlight the Arab presence at the conference, because that was significant. But although it was a pretty low-level Syrian representative there, but still, you know, that kind of buy-in from key Arab states is good in principle. I guess the main reason, in a certain sense, I have for skepticism is that it seems to be a relatively kind of laissez-faire approach that they're taking. You know, Condoleezza Rice seems to be leaving it largely in the hands of Israelis and Palestinians. And there is a line of thought, I mean, with some guidance and supervision and coaxing, to be sure, but there is a line of thought that what you really need is the exact opposite, which is to say, and I think Daniel Levy, who was on the site earlier this week, this former Israeli negotiator, is identified with this position. And the idea is that the United States gets together with other key players, I don't know, maybe Russia, maybe Arab states, and specify what the deal is. Yeah, of course, in consultation with Israelis and Palestinians, but it isn't a negotiation initially between Israelis and Palestinians. This external group says, here is the deal. Take it or we're behind this. We think it's fair for both of you. Whoever walks away from this is to blame for what happens next. And one reason that's important is because, you know, any deal that's going to work is probably going to be hard for both leaders to sell to their people. And so they need to be able to some extent to blame it on somebody. In the Israeli case, Olmert needs to be able to say, look, the Americans are insisting. And that has valence in Israel, you know. But
why? I thought your whole position was the Palestinian, that Abbas has to be seen as wresting these concessions from Israel, and you even want to stage manage it so concessions Israel is perfectly willing to give look like they've been wrested by Abbas. So if Abbas is forced to accept a deal without having negotiated it and won it in hard bargaining, doesn't that emasculate him? And doesn't it contradict your earlier advice?
Well, I guess if they see the process of Olmert saying to the people, I know this hurts and you don't want to do it, but America, you know, insists, A, and B, if you have this Arab buy-in, you know, from Saudi Arabia, maybe from Syria, certainly from Jordan, then, you know, that helps the boss sell it. But,
well, I agree that it helps sell it if it looks like Israel is grudgingly giving up something under the weight of either, you know, Palestinian pressure or world opinion that it otherwise wouldn't want to give up. So it looks like a victory. I agree with that. But why not just let them win a victory? I don't know.
Well, because we've tried that, and I mean, there are some, you know, it's hard. And also, I mean, the thinking is, the Israeli leader actually needs to be able to point to external pressure and say, look, we got to do this in order to sell it to the people.
Right.
And also the sheer complexity of the negotiation, and we've tried it before, and we never quite get there. And the thinking is, just you know, do it out to the last detail and lay it on the table and say, this is it.
The is, as a general rule, is it true that this truism that strong leaders can make peace, weak leaders can't? Why should that be true? Why can't weak leaders have to make peace and then their people are stuck with it? Why is it, you have two weak leaders, why can't they make peace?
Well, because the idea is there's something in a viable deal that major constituencies in both sides will resist, and strong leaders have the political capital to deal with that, and weak leaders don't.
Okay.
I mean, in Abbas's case, it's strength in a very literal sense. You know, do you control violence within your territory? And that's been the problem on the Palestinian side, and that's another reason to be skeptical. You know, that's always been the big problem on the Palestinian side, or a big problem, is that you know, you're never dealing with somebody who demonstrably has and claims to have really control over, you know, the use of violence, which is the definition of having a coherent government, and it's kind of less true than ever, in a way, that you have a government that truly controls violence, at least in the sense that they definitely have no control over Gaza right now.
But it's so
and things are a little dicey in the West Bank.
It's so far from true on the Palestinian side that it will never be true that you have a strong leader who controls all the factions.
Well, of course, this was part of the argument for accepting the Hamas election victory and saying, okay, now you're a real government, start acting like one. And deal with him. Hamas had a better chance probably than anybody ever of actually controlling the violence. I mean, they have some splinter groups, you know, Islamic Jihad to deal with, but by and large, I would have been hard-pressed to believe the claim that they did not have it in their capacity to control the violence.
And do you think any of the Democratic presidential candidates would have opted for that strategy?
Well, no. In American political circles, it was deemed suicide to mention it. Not even relatively liberal, you know, newspapers.
I mean, Barack's got to talk to Castro. Why shouldn't he talk? You would think he would be the most likely to go for that.
Well, even that is a little politically dicey, given what a pivotal state Florida is.
Yes.
And, you know, you multiply that
but
by
about
eight.
But he stuck with it. But he bizarrely stuck with it.
Yeah, well, okay, maybe he learned his lesson there and decided not to take on a larger political challenge.
Well, the Hamas thing is water under the bridge now, but... I was just curious as to...
Yeah, no, look, I am the skeptical one. Don't, you know, I agree with you. It's a big, you know, that's why I think when you have these rare moments when you might at least have somebody you can actually deal with on the Palestinian side who is responsible, who can be held responsible for violence emanating from that area, you might think twice before isolating.
But there is this favorable dynamic that the Saudis are terrified of the Iranians, so they sort of have a renewed... I don't know, why does that make them... want to solve the Palestinian dispute more?
I guess because the Palestinian dispute is, you know, half of the bread and butter for Hezbollah, I guess, and for, you know, I mean, Iran loves an unsettled, you know, Palestine. That's, you know, they win.
I guess that's right.
So, but you know, Iran figures in another kind of interesting way, which is if you ask what kind of leverage. Does Bush have, you know, in the next year, pretty accelerated timetable, right, to try to get Israel to make major concessions? What kind of leverage does he, what can he offer Israel in exchange for making major concessions to achieve peace? Well, can you imagine one that involves Iran?
You mean, so he says, you make peace and we'll bomb Iran?
Either bomb Iran or support your bombing. Right. So you make peace in this area, and we'll make sure there's a war in this area.
Is that a bad deal?
Oh, I can imagine preferable ones. I don't, you know, whether it would be a net gain or loss, I don't know. But I'd rather it just be kind of, you know, just peace, period, rather than peace plus war myself, but...
Joe Biden must see something like that coming because he's actually become completely unrespectable and called for the impeachment of Bush if he attacks Iran.
Biden? I didn't know that. Well, I think it's about Hail Mary time in the political campaign.
No,
for
that
him.
Too, but still.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised he's not calling for the execution of Bush if Bush, you know, I mean, he really needs to do something radical.
And he's sort of a... you know, he mouths off, but it was still sort of shocking.
Well, it's not totally crazy when you know, if you want to take the Constitution seriously, it's supposed to be the case that Congress is, you know, has the power to make war or not make war, and that would not be an easily dismissible argument for impeachment. It's just that, you know, we've ceased to take that part of the Constitution seriously, apparently, but it's there.
Well, I think we ceased to take it seriously in Thomas Jefferson's day. He had an undeclared war on the Barbary Pirates. Sent a whole fleet over
there.
Yeah,
but at least that wasn't a nation state.
I think it was pretty much Libya.
Was it?
Anyway, I wait the movie. It's in Christopher Hitchens' book. Not surprisingly, he presents it as a unilateral war. But, I think he did notify Congress, but after the ships were over the horizon and could not be recalled.
No longer the case. We can always recall them now until the bombs fall.
We spent like 20 minutes on something.
I know. We'll breeze through the rest because the rest is like your stuff, and so I'll just like nap or something. Iraq, you want to talk about Iraq?
The first one is the Iraq. I want to point out a couple things. First, the sentiment seems to be near unanimous that the surge is having some beneficial effect.
Well, I think what's unanimous is that things are improving somewhat, and the extent to which you attribute that to the surge is a matter of disagreement. But anyway,
some combination of the surge and the tribal strategy is having an
and having the fact that ethnic cleansing played itself out in some areas
too.
And created homogeneous neighborhoods and so on.
That too, but the general strategy of reducing the al-Qaeda threat, which reduces the excuse of the Maqbi army to say, you know, we're your only defense against al-Qaeda, and generally lowering the cycle of violence, that seems to be actually playing out.
Yes, although a lot of the neutralization of al-Qaeda didn't have anything to do with the surge. It had to do with the Sunnis turning against al-Qaeda.
The argument is, why not let it continue? And this is dilemma that the Democratic candidates are in. They're all sort of, they've all been pissing on the surge and saying the surge isn't working, and now they're stuck with the fact that they are sort of unable to say the war was a stupid idea, but the surge was a good idea. The only person who's really done that is this guy Baird, a congressman, who voted against the war, but says, well, I voted against the war was a stupid idea. But the surge is working. We should give it a shot. And it seems to me he's exactly right. Of course, he's excoriated and pilloried and excommunicated by the left. But he actually represents the position that I think the Democratic candidates are going to have to gravitate towards. And there was an interesting article by Cliff May suggesting...
You call him Cliff? Are you on a first-name basis with all the neocons, are you?
I think his name is Cliff May.
Isn't the byline Clifford?
I thought it was... I don't know.
You call him Cliff. Anyway, it's okay.
You know, I read The Corner, so I feel like I know
Cliff.
All these people. I've never met this man in my life.
But, Mickey and Cliff.
If his name is really Cliff, Bob, you're in big trouble.
I think it's Clifford.
He says that people, interestingly, that Democrats find it easier to gravitate to the pro-surge position if they voted against the war. It's the people who voted for the war and who are now... you know, like Harry Reid saying the war is lost and the surge isn't going to work, who have great trouble flipping back again for a second time to the pro-surge position. But I think there's sort of more to it than that. It's the people who voted for the war who then have to appease the Netroots by being against the surge and pissing on everything Bush does in Iraq, whereas if you were against the war from the beginning, you sort of have the freedom to say, well, overall the war was a stupid idea, but... we can salvage something out of it.
Well, yeah, but as a practical matter, I mean, some of the people who opposed the war, like Obama, came out against the surge when the surge started, and those positions are dug in. I mean, everyone's position is established on the surge. No people who have not opposed the surge are now going to come out in opposition to it.
The import of the Clifford May article is that Obama has a freedom that Hillary doesn't have. Since Obama voted against the war, He would, according to this theory, have the freedom to say nicer things about the surge. And
well,
I, you
yeah,
know,
the complication
are,
is what he said about it in the past.
Politicians are very flexible. I agree that the Democrats have dug themselves a hole here. They're like Hollywood coming out with all these anti-war movies right at the time when the public opinion is in the process of shifting. But politicians are very flexible and good at extricating themselves from holes they've dug themselves, and especially Hillary. And I would think we will see some of that. But I think Beard is the model here.
Well, but again, it's too late. Either they've opposed the surge or they haven't. And if they've opposed the surge, that's the problem they face. That's the problem Obama faces.
Well, so they.
I mean, assuming things continue to improve, that is.
Yeah. You think that's true? Suppose they say, "Well, I was against the war; it's a stupid idea. But I was skeptical of the surge, but it seems to be showing some results. It was still a stupid war, but you know."
Well,
I think, first of all,
and
then somebody comes back and says, "You know, but you said in January that the surge was a joke." Does that do that much damage? I don't know.
Well, look, let's, I mean, first of all, let's look at what Obama could say that actually is the truth and would be exculpatory.
Right.
And you tell me if it would play politically. I think it probably would not, but just
okay.
For the sake of departing from usual Washington dialogue,
yeah.
Let's actually imagine that a politician just said, what is the truth? What he could say that's truthful is, I said the surge would not work, and indeed, the surge by itself would not have worked had it not been... for the fact that A, the Sunnis happened to turn on al-Qaeda, and B, that the ethnic cleansing, maybe this could have been anticipated, but it wasn't part of the surge plan, that the ethnic cleansing would play itself out in these neighborhoods. If those two things had not happened, nobody would be hailing the success of the surge because the improvement of the situation would not be dramatic enough. However, I'm glad that these things happened, and I don't deny that the surge had enough of a positive effect in combination with those things to be helpful in combination with those things. So we're in a better place than when we were, and that's good. Okay, that's what he could say about what his current position on the surge is.
I'm certainly in favor of that. I guess that's the position he'll take on January 4th after he wins the Iowa caucuses. The problem is we have these caucuses where a tiny minority of Iowa citizens who tend to be the most peacenik vote, and I think
why is Iowa so far? I don't get it. Why is Iowa so far left? Is it?
It's a caucus system. Who shows up at meetings? The most committed people. That's how the Leninists take over. They're the only people who show up at the meetings. So you have to show up at a caucus in the middle of the night. Mm. Who's going to show up at that? It's not like 4%, but it's way less than the participation in a primary where you just have to vote, and that skews against the middle of the road.
Okay.
It's
good answer.
Pretty obvious.
Hey, you don't have to get personal about it.
So
I complimented you on your answer,
okay.
And you have to like insult me for asking the question.
Poor,
okay, fine. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You enlighten us further.
I was insulting me. I was saying it's pretty obvious. I don't deserve the kudos for this answer.
Yeah, it sounded like a humble utterance coming out. Go ahead.
The other interesting thing is I attack this op-ed by the Center for American Progress, sort of, which was one of the last attempts to criticize the surge and say, you know, we need a pushback against the surge, and we still need to withdraw and set a timetable, et cetera, et cetera. And it made the argument that, well, the surge is working against the stated goals of the invasion, which is a unified Iraq, because and there's a blogger called Lawyers, Guns, and Money who fleshed this out, and Kevin Drum did, because it's building up the tribes against the state. But the argument is that even that will help, even if you believe in if you don't believe in a unified Iraq, you build up the tribes, Iraq devolves into its various regions, it might be a stable status quo, but it's not the stated goal of a unified Iraq. But it could actually achieve the stated goal of a unified Iraq if we rebalanced the power between the Sunnis and the Shiites, so the Sunnis were negotiating from a position of strength and security and did not feel that merging peacefully into the Shiite-dominated state was going to lead to their slaughter. And that, in fact, is exactly, apparently, the strategy as outlined by this fellow Kilcullen in an article in Small Wars Journal, which I urge everybody to read and will link to. It's a bottom-up strategy. We're rebalancing the power between the various tribes.
He's a military guy, right? He's Australian or what? But he's in the military.
I think he's from New Zealand. He was an advisor to Petraeus. He's a specialist in counterinsurgency.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this article, a too-long article in Small Wars Journal. Large articles about small wars. And that's basically the theory. The theory is even though we're empowering the various regions, the goal is that ultimately down the road, they will cut some sort of deal. And, you know, it is sort of silly, as long as there's peace, it is sort of silly to expect them to cut the deal immediately by saying, okay, we're going to leave and threaten chaos unless you cut a deal next month, which is the Democrat strategy. Why not let them, you know, build up confidence for a couple of years with a continuing American troop presence, and then they can cut the deal? I don't see what the... Even if you accept that they will not cut the deal until we threaten to leave, why threaten to leave now as opposed to 2 years from now when the balance of power is rebalanced?
Well, first of all, the scenario you laid out does confirm what I said earlier, which is that the surge per se would not have worked. What's happening is in many ways the opposite of what was envisioned by the proponents of the surge. It was supposed to help unify Iraq, and you and I have discussed this, the paradox, that what they've wound up doing along with the surge is decentralizing power, giving guns to the Sunnis, establishing these independent sources of power, making unification... less like. So first of all, you concede that, right? This is not what the architects of the surge had in mind.
Well, so what? This is the standard anti-Bush.
Okay, I'm just saying.
But it's not working toward your stated goal, or it's not working in the way you wanted it to. Well, if it's working, who cares about the stated goals?
No, but
Kilcullen admits that it's not working the way it was originally envisioned. It was supposed to provide security to have a political deal, and instead there was a political deal before the surge that provided the security. So what?
Okay.
He says he agrees with you. So what?
Okay. Have you regained your equilibrium now?
That was an attempt at a Bob Wright-like rant.
It was good. It was good. I mean, you're not quite there, but it was, you're doing what you can.
Yeah.
I just say that because we were asking earlier, well, what can Obama say? Or what can somebody who opposes the surge say? Well, they can say the surge per se just did not work, and they were not crazy to oppose the whole strategy of which it was part. Okay. Forget that, though.
But they were.
The other part is, you can lay out this scenario where it all works out wonderfully, but as Kevin Drum put it, it looks to him just as plausibly like you're setting the stage for warlordism. It isn't just really that you're giving the Sunnis some power and that then the Shiites have power, so those two sides have to work it out. I suspect that if you look at the facts on the ground in the Sunni area, the power is decentralized there too. That is, it's a tribal social structure, and you've probably got a lot of centers of power among the Sunnis. And that's a recipe for warlordism in the absence of order. Now, you may say, well, so we should stick around and make sure that the warlordism doesn't have time to settle in.
Well, Kilcullen talks about this threat of warlordism, and it says it's a real threat, and what Kevin Drum says is true, and it might work out that way. He thinks it won't, and he outlines a series of what he calls mitigation measures that they've taken to try to make sure it doesn't happen. He thinks it'll work, but it's a close thing, yes.
Yeah.
But it's worth trying. It's better than just pulling out the props from everything.
Could be. Yeah, no, I have not been an advocate of especially early withdrawal myself, in that op-ed to which you refer, I think they were laying out a firm timetable of 12 to 18 months. That seems a little quick to me. I would settle for them. In my mind, a more important thing is that we not have the idea of, in the long run, using Iraq as a military platform for the United States. In other words, that we do get the troops out. And there is the logical concern that the longer you leave them in, the more likely they are to more likely Iraq is, or parts of it, to become an American aircraft carrier. Whereas I think, like some other people, that the way to deploy the force in that part of the world is actually on aircraft carriers. It's called offshore balance.
You don't even want a base in Kurdistan?
Not especially, no. I mean, it's the virtue there is that it's less antagonistic. It does much less antagonizing in the local populace. On the other hand, it has just as much, I guess, propaganda. Well, wait a second. Does it have as much propaganda value? I'd have to look at my Al Qaeda rhetoric to see how what use that would be.
I mean,
put
we have
to.
Big bases in Turkey, right?
Well, yeah, but that's definitely not part of Arabia in any sense. And you may be right about Kurdistan. I mean, I'd have to check. But there is this argument that you can deploy force on aircraft carriers, you know, around the region so that you're as capable as you would be to intervene in any event, pretty much, and it doesn't have the downside. It's called offshore balancing.
Gary Hart lives. That was his strategy.
I'm with him.
We know that. From last week. We're on the same page, Bob.
Are we?
Yes.
No, I must. Then I better turn the page.
I'll
turn the page.
You picked up on the crappy segue that I was setting up.
What are we turning the page to? More presidential candidates or what?
It's as if we finished each other's sentences, Bob.
You complete me, Mickey.
I think we're talking about presidential candidates. Couple of points.
Okay.
Hillary's panicking. She's in deep trouble.
Now, how did she get into the trouble? You know, I increasingly, you know...
She got into trouble by having Iowa be the first in the nation, contest where it's an unfavorable terrain for her, and she's committed herself to it, and if she loses there, she's in deep trouble.
And then is New Hampshire very different demographically?
New Hampshire is very different demographically, much more conservative.
So you got it. So this is like, I mean, can I just do a tangent? I mean, the primary system is so increasingly screwed up. I mean, they got to get control of the states. The party has got to get control of the state party apparatus.
Yeah, well, they just had a big meeting on that, and they said, "Oh, we'll get control next time."
It's a disaster. They just don't have time to sort things out in a rational way.
Well, so you're supposed to
take this left turn to win Iowa, and then this right turn to win New Hampshire, and then it's like basically all over within like what? How many days after New Hampshire?
Well, it's all over by February 5th, so 1 month after Iowa, or 1 month minus five days after New Hampshire.
It's crazy. Okay, so she got into trouble, but it's not just that Iowa is left wing, the caucuses at least. Her prospects actually have diminished a little in Iowa because of something.
Well, Iowa is always often decided in the last 2 weeks. Somebody surges from the pack, and we're not even at the last 2 weeks yet, and already Obama has surged enough that he's ahead in most polls.
That's too soon.
It is a little too soon. I agree. She could come back, but. On the other hand, she could finish third.
And what do things look like in New Hampshire in the polls?
Well, in New Hampshire, she's ahead, but it's tightening. But the New Hampshire polls are irrelevant right now because
it's her firewall.
Well, but it's a stupid firewall. As it was pointed out, it's stupid of her to declare it's her firewall because that establishes the expectation that if she loses that, she's through. Which is very silly of her, because there is a chance that if she loses both, she could recover.
Did she declare that it's her firewall?
Well, there have been sort of, I think, stories in the press about how it's her firewall, citing campaign aides who brilliantly, you know, point this out.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Anyway, the New Hampshire polls changed the day after Iowa, and the winner of Iowa surges. So that's what happened with John Kerry. That's what happened with Gary Hart. That's what always happens. So it's
so Obama could be the next president. You think if Obama, if Obama wins Iowa, he has a good chance of winning New Hampshire, you think?
Yeah.
And if he wins Iowa and New Hampshire, he has a good chance of winning the whole thing?
Well, then he wins South Carolina, and then he really does have a good chance. Yes, but you know, this is the crazy thought I had. If it's Obama versus Huckabee,
yeah,
there's got to be a third candidate. Those are two wacky choices.
I don't think Obama's wacky.
He's not as wacky as Huckabee, but he's easily caricatured as a sort of too left for America candidate, and Huckabee is easily caricatured as a guy who doesn't believe in Darwin. So
define this third party candidate. What niche is left after that?
Well, I don't know who would be left.
Fiscal conservative, first of all, right?
I could see McCain stepping in.
Yeah.
What's he got to lose? I could see a whole bunch of people stepping. If Hillary was, I guess Hillary has a career in the Senate, so she can't really well do this. But if I were Hillary and thought this was my one chance to be president, I would become a third party candidate. I mean, I think we may have four or five third party candidates. It's not that hard anymore.
You were saying Hillary is panicking in Iowa, right?
He'd be fiscally conservative and middle of the road on all issues and tough on immigration. There you go.
Oh, so neither of them is anti-immigration. So fiscal conservative, anti-immigration candidate.
Or he'd advocate
the complication there.
But the immigration may not be that important.
Well, there's also the complication that there's this overlap with the social values people, right? Aren't a lot of the immigration, anti-immigration people social values people?
Yeah, well, that's but
and Huckabee does have them.
Huckabee has social values people, but he's pro-immigration, so.
I understand that, but. The really solid niche would open up if it were more coherent in that regard. If he were not, well, anyway.
Yeah,
so Hillary is panicking, you're saying.
Anyway, I think Hillary is panicking, and she's now trying this sort of coordinated attack on the difference between an individual mandate in healthcare and not. And it really does seem like too fine a point, as Tim Noah points out in Slate. Even an individual mandate won't achieve universal coverage. The way to achieve universal coverage is to have universal coverage, the way Bill Clinton had in his plan, which is everybody gets a card, and the card entitles them to health insurance.
I'm for that.
So the second thing is the sort of filer faster principle is playing out in that there's so much time between now and Iowa. You know, there's time for Obama to fall and rise again and fall again and rise again. It's going to be very hard for him to sustain his vague campaign of hope for 3 weeks. I mean, that's like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So there was good article in Real Clear Politics about how you need a second and third act just to keep people entertained at this point, whereas previously you didn't. I will predict and stake a certain something, I don't know, face on the prediction that at some point there will be a scandal that will materially affect the race.
Well, I see you've been trying to start one on your blog. I mean, Mickey, you are really pathetic.
Which scandal are you talking about?
Oh, I took the paragraph. I mean, this Hillary thing. I mean, give me a break, okay?
I got into some trouble on the Hillary thing.
I sure hope so. And that's pathetic.
I'm not pushing that. I just...
No, you are pushing it.
I'm not pushing it.
Give publicity to it, you're pushing it.
If it's being used to smear her in South Carolina, there's an article, two articles on it in the Sunday Times of London.
Well, let's tell people what we're talking about, okay?
It's on the front page of Drudge.
Yeah.
It seems to me that then you can comment on that... How this rumor is might.
What is the rumor, Mickey?
Hillary has this very good-looking female aide who's her body person, meaning she's the person who wakes her up in the morning and puts her to bed at night and picks up the phone and
puts her. Come on, Mickey. That's not part of the classic description of a body person.
No, Jeff Greenfield talks about tucking Bobby Kennedy in.
Okay, go ahead. What's the rumor? What's the rumor?
The rumor is obviously that without any evidence at all, people are assuming that they haven't. Maybe they're having an affair.
Okay, now let's. You said once it's on Drudge, I'm all for amplifying it. Okay, let's talk about how it got.
I did not amplify it. I mentioned it.
Mickey, if you've got a blog with a following in a major magazine like Slate, you're amplifying it.
But you're saying I can't even denounce it. If I denounce it, I'm amplifying it.
You didn't even denounce it, first of all.
I'm not going to denounce it. I don't know if it's true or not. I said I wrote a piece saying Hillary has a problem denying it because the Clintons have a history of lying about sex scandals, and they've thrown their credibility away. That seemed like a point worth making. I also said that just blogging it isn't going to put it in the mainstream because the mainstream seems quite resistant to letting scandals bubble up from blogs.
That's total bullshit. What about the Dan Rather story, the National Guard story? That didn't start on blogs?
Stories can start on blogs, but the Dan Rather story was, there was a lot of evidence for it, and so it got picked up by the mainstream press. That's the way it's supposed to work. What people worry about is that things that aren't true bubble up from blogs into the mainstream press and affect the election, like this rumor.
I would just like to recount how it got to the point where you considered it legitimate to, I would say, amplify it. You would say, mysteriously, that putting it on your blog has no influence at all on how widely circulated it is, which calls into question the whole point of having a blog.
I'm saying it doesn't add very much to the front page of Drudge.
Okay, let me just finish.
Amplifies it by 1,000, then maybe I add 0.1%.
Well, we all have whatever influence we have, and we either use it conscientiously or we don't.
I weigh that against that I had some points to make about it.
Okay, let me just recount how it actually came to be on Drudge. Okay, a guy in the Times of London, right? Tim something?
Right.
Writes this piece. The whole point is how these days, especially when you get to, what is it, South Carolina this was about?
Right.
How these trashy rumors circulate. And he has a paragraph full of rumors that no sane person would take seriously. For example, that have been circulating via email and so on. For example, Rudy Giuliani's wife supported the killing of innocent puppies.
But don't
Wait. Can I finish this, Mickey? Barack Obama is a Muslim extremist. Okay? These are things everyone knows are not true. And one of them is Hillary Clinton was having a lesbian affair with Huma Abed. And first of all, you don't mention any of the other things. But Drudge, you know, being the extremely serious journalist he is, uses this thing, right, as the occasion to flack this story about Hillary, right? And you go with the flow.
You forgot to mention that the Times is owned by Rupert Murdoch, Bob. You're missing a point.
Fine, the point is, anybody reading this paragraph knows that the whole point is to dismiss everything in here. Drudge, you know, being not responsible, does what he does, and then you, being fill-in-the-blank, do what you did.
Well, it's actually not clear that the point was to dismiss everything that was in there, because they ran a picture of Hillary and this woman as to accompany the story, and the caption of the picture said...
Well, that's because they didn't have pictures of the innocent puppies, Mickey.
You know how the news works. You run the pictures, you got
a picture of an attractive woman, you always run that.
The caption of the picture...
Probably hard to track down those innocent puppies.
Can I get in a word? The caption of the picture said Hillary Clinton and her aide, who are rumored to be having an affair. So that doesn't say who are the it didn't say the subject of a vicious, sleazy slur. So you can see the hand of Murdoch there, but you can't say that the whole purpose of the story was to dismiss it. At some point, Murdoch and Drudge actually inject an elephant into the room that you have to comment on. And under your theory, you couldn't even criticize it. You have to maintain mum, because to criticize, you'd have to mention the word Huma Abedin, and you can't do that.
I have one more thing to say.
My line is that it's... Well, let me say my line. Right, you say your thing.
No, Mickey, I insist.
No, go first. No, you go, Bob.
No, really, Mickey.
No, Bob, we want to know what... I know what I'm going to say. I'm eager to learn what you want to say.
You know, but I'm actually in a comparable position. I'm
But you're going to forget it. I'm not going to forget it.
Why? What, you're saying I'm older than you? I'm not. You're older.
That's below the belt. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is going to change the subject slightly.
Okay,
so if this is on this stupid rumor, go ahead. Go ahead. You finish.
My point is that it's an absurd rumor. It's like a joke. You have this glamorous woman who's like, pictured in Vogue, and Oscar de la Renta says he doesn't want to die before he sees her in a strapless gown. And, It's the subject for Jay Leno jokes. It should not be a big deal in the campaign.
Your blog item did not treat it like that, actually. But let me just say one thing,
it does
okay?
Treat it like that.
In terms of how you choose which scandals you focus on and which you don't. As you may recall, last time we talked, I told you that while in Washington, I had heard a rumor that there might be a scandal emerging about Giuliani that involved actual documentary evidence.
You may have said that, yes.
Now, I actually don't know whether what I had heard vaguely about is the thing that broke. But Ben Smith in the Politico wrote a thing about that did involve some documentary evidence. Apparently Giuliani, these documents about how state funds were spent suggested that some state funds were spent to facilitate these liaisons he was having in the Hamptons or something like that, right? Well, I may have it a little wrong, but you know the story,
he's
right?
He's followed everywhere by his security detail. So yeah, when he goes to visit his honey in the Hamptons,
Did you blog this?
The security detail follows him.
Did you blog this?
No, I didn't, Bob.
No, I emailed you the link to the Ben Smith story within like 3 hours of when it broke.
Everybody else knew
it was futile because you would, never publicize a legitimate scandal about a Republican when you can spend your time publicizing total bullshit about a Democrat.
I publicize a legitimate scandal about Giuliani that I think is much more serious. I mean, obviously, everybody knows he had this ridiculous security detail and the taxpayers had to pay for it somehow. So what?
So that wasn't a story.
It's much more of a scandal if he, in fact, located the anti-terrorist headquarters in the World Trade Center so that he and Bernard Kerik could have love nests in Battery Park City, where, as a result that it was located at the very spot that the terrorists were committed to blowing up. That would be a more serious dereliction of duty.
Yeah, but there's no evidence that happened, is there? I mean, he did
he did locate it there against the advice of people who said, wait, we're putting it on the 10th floor of a building that they've tried to blow up. Isn't that stupid? So he did do that, and it did blow up. So it's
But he could have just as easily put it in the basement, and if all he wanted was the apartment nearby, so that doesn't make sense.
But why was it at that site? And that is the place where... It's probably not true, but that is what people... It's a rumor as unfounded as the other one.
That's totally stupid. I mean, anywhere he put it, he could have found an apartment nearby. I don't understand what you're saying.
The second thing is... The second thing is a big piece Jim Pinkerton made, about, you know, everybody knew there was this trouble with the interoperability of the radios before 9/11, and he didn't fix it. So the result of 9/11 was that the firefighters didn't know what the hell was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a serious problem, a dereliction of duty. And so I gave that one play on my side, Bob, to show
okay,
you
Okay, I applaud that. And I want to apologize for the several outbursts in the last few minutes.
No, we like the outbursts.
I know. But what happened is I drank my coffee late, and it just hit me right in the middle of the damn dialogue.
Anyway,
but I'm over that.
Anyway, the point is, I'm not pushing this Hillary aid rumor. I am pushing the Edwards rumor. And I didn't make that clear enough to my readers that that you can accuse me of pushing the Edwards rumor. I'm pushing that one. We'll see what happens. I have no particular reason to think that the Hillary rumor has any truth to it at all.
Okay, we're at 52 minutes, and supposedly we were going to do Pakistan group selection and viewer comments.
Let's just do group selection.
Can I quickly say my I'll just do the Pakistan point in like 2.1 minutes, okay?
That's a long time. It's an eternity in modern politics.
Okay. Last time, about Pakistan, I just said, you know, I didn't know about the propping up dictator strategy with Pakistan. When you look at where we are with Pakistan compared to when we first started propping up Pakistani dictators, I don't see how it's paid off. In the meanwhile, Pakistan has done us the favor of exporting nuclear weapon technology to like every bad country in the world, roughly. Meanwhile, they have failed to control this anti-American kind of al-Qaeda part of Pakistan. What exactly? What's the upside? And by the way, the commenter known as Exus99 had a good comment pointing out that things could be even worse. You know, it's not, you know, maybe they would have been even worse if we hadn't been propping up dictators. You do have to use your imagination a little to see them being much worse, but okay, valid point. Anyway, I just, there's one other thing I want to say here, which I think gets to a fundamental point about American foreign policy, which is like burden sharing, okay? When Pakistan enters this crisis it's in now, okay, and all eyes turn to America. Like, what's America going to do? Gosh, there's this question of leadership. Pakistan's got nuclear weapons. They've got this al-Qaeda thing. What is America going to do? Well, why should it only be our problem? Presumably, if these nukes got loose or if al-Qaeda, you know, gets more powerful, that's not just a problem for America. It's a problem for a lot of nations, right?
Right.
So why do we accept the role, which we gleefully embraced in the case of invading Iraq, of doing these global policing things that we claim are good for everyone, but we accept the premise that we will accept pretty much all of the fiscal cost and the cost in blood and the blowback. Now, first of all, I think this should be the talking point of a Democratic candidate. Burden sharing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Why should we be the world's policeman for free? And secondly, I just want to say, there is, if there is an answer, I mean, you would be, you'd be tempted to say, well, the deal is, we're Al-Qaeda's number one enemy. Those nukes are most likely to be used against us. Well, maybe, maybe not. It's true that a disproportionate share of the wrath of radical Muslims is directed against the United States. But if you ask why that is, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we keep accepting this role of being the ones who will prop up the dictators and incur the wrath of the local radical Muslims who don't like the dictators and just antagonize the locals generally. And it's this kind of vicious circle where, you know, the more we intervene, you know, the more we are the targets of the terrorists, and that fact is used to justify the next intervention, which will make the terrorists focus on us only more.
We've got to
get out of this vicious circle.
Is there any other candidate for the chief actor other than the United Nations?
Oh, sure. There's various kinds of coalitions you can imagine. I mean, even when you get NATO, as opposed to just the U.S. to take something on, as was the case in Kosovo, as was not the case in Iraq. I mean, but in the long term, I'm imagining institutional arrangements like, you know, revolution and arms control structures and so on. But just for now, I think it would be a service for a Democratic candidate to point out how screwed up the situation we've got ourselves in. With the eager support of George Bush.
I forget, what was your good point? What was your position on the League of Democracies? You don't like it?
Oh, I hate it. Concert of Democracies, generally called. It's a neocon idea. Oh, you really want to get me started? I will only say that the obvious effect of it would to establish fissures between the West and the Arab world, on the one hand, because those Arab countries, by and large, aren't going to be admitted to this Concert of Democracies, and between the West and China. Because China's not going to be admitted.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you ask who favors those two cleavages, it's neocons. Who wants a war against A, the Arab world, and B, China?
Well, if you do,
the neocons.
NATO doesn't really differ all that much from the Concert of Democracies, does it?
Well, that's why Giuliani is proposing this kind of backdoor approach to the Concert of Democracies, of expanding NATO in terms of the numbers of countries. It encompasses, you know, Australia and so on, and I think expanding its mission in terms of trying to make it a legitimizing, a force that could legitimately intervene all over the world.
But if you say you're for NATO intervening, then what's your argument against that?
Well, I wouldn't. What they want to do very explicitly is make NATO replace the United Nations as the intervening force.
But you just accepted that NATO could replace the United Nations as the United Nations.
Well, my first resort would be the United Nations. Obviously, the more consensus, the better. David Frum had this argument with Heather Hurlburt, and he very explicitly doesn't want it to be the United Nations. He wants it to be NATO. And also, we would have huge differences over when you intervene. And you know, in a case like Pakistan now, we're not talking about a NATO-like intervention at all. I'm talking just abstractly that the U.S. should increasingly say, look, we got a problem here that's a threat to the whole world. We're not going to do it alone. If you want to help, fine, we can talk about it. If not, we're not going to do it either. I mean, call their bluff. You know, if you're going to be a serious bargainer and try to get people to shoulder the burden, you got to be willing to say no, and you can't get panicked into intervening in everything that seems like it could plausibly.
It seems to me they call our bluff and then we lose.
Well, the way it works in those situations is everybody loses if they call your bluff, and maybe if they call it once and everybody loses, maybe next time they won't call it.
I agree that it's a good talking point for the Democrats.
That's all I want. More than 2 minutes.
Group selection. I watched our segment where we promised we'd talk about group selection.
Was it totally incoherent?
It was surprisingly coherent, but your eye-rolling exhibition...
What did I do?
You were unbelievable. You rolled your eyes farther than I thought eyes could roll. When I suggested that in your book where you sort of dismiss the idea of group selection, and I guess I should attempt to, and you could just interrupt me at any point and correct me. when I read your book, The Moral Animal, which is about evolutionary psychology, you basically propound the selfish gene theory, which is that evolution takes place at the level of the individual and the individual gene. So the characteristics that are good for the individual are the ones that survive and flourish. And the idea let me finish one sentence. That the idea that the characteristics that are good for the group flourish is a canard, and I point out that the group selection, the second theory, is in fact coming back in contradiction to what you wrote in your book.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Take it away.
Well, first of all, should we do a little... Okay, how much context do we need? Evolutionary psychology was this attempt to explain human nature and, you know... first of all, the assertion, there is a human nature. It evolved by natural selection. It, in some sense, you know, to some extent, is grounded in the genes. And when I wrote The Moral Animal, that was actually still kind of a controversial... Believe it or not, it was a controversial school of thought, okay? Now, first of all, the fact that now suddenly the argument is between individual selectionists and group selectionists, if it is, I would say, a sign that evolutionary psychology has won. It's like, if it's Protestants versus Catholics, Christianity has won, okay?
Okay.
And so it's an interesting fact that in this post you pointed me to in the Huffington Post, this guy hailing the victory of group selection over individual selectionism is exactly the I would predict the person would have been dismissing evolutionary psychology altogether 15 years ago.
Right. It doesn't mean that our genes are unimportant and that all that matters is nurture and that human beings are infinitely malleable. Is that what you mean?
Evolutionary psychology means that people are not infinitely malleable as a practical matter. Doesn't mean they're not malleable.
Right. Anyway, I pointed you to a post which we'll link to again where the guy hailed the triumph of group selection as if he was hailing the diminution of importance of genes, and you're pointing out that's not what it means. It means there's still a human nature. It's just a question of how the human nature gets determined.
Well, I mean, in terms of the misconceptions in his piece, there are a few things I would argue.
Continue with your rap. Sorry.
Okay. You said the selfish gene theory. I mean, my position in The Moral Animal and individual selection versus group selection was largely an individual selectionist one. I did say this doesn't mean group selection can't happen. It means that the circumstances under which it will happen are thought by most people to have been rare during human evolution. I said something like that. I guess I should pause and explain kind of what... You have to. The easiest way to introduce this is via history. I should have done this in the beginning. Okay. In the 1950s, before what I would call the modern Darwinian revolution of the 60s and 70s, which I think created the theoretical foundation of evolutionary psychology, in the 1950s, it was common to resort to group selection in a very casual way. Okay. You notice, for example, that in some species, suppose it's a moose. Okay.
Yeah.
Could be. That in times of scarcity, you see that they restrain their reproduction. They don't have offspring when there's a really barren year. And the explanation trotted out was, well, that's for the good of the group. They're all restraining their own like reproductive appetites because they know that if they have more kids, it will put a stress on the ecosystem or more offspring, and the whole group will be wiped out.
Right.
Well, that's a nice story. As it turned out, upon closer analysis, it looks more like, actually, it was the case that from the individual's point of view, having the offspring's chances of survival would be so dim in that environment that it made sense at an individual level to inhibit reproduction, okay?
Right.
And when I say made sense, I don't mean the animals thinking about
it.
I mean, that's the implicit logic of the selection of genes that had happened.
Right.
Okay. So there had been all this so-called naive group selectionism, and increasingly in the 60s and 70s, it was discovered that actually you can explain even things like altruism without saying it's because it's for the good of the group at large. Okay? Now this brings us to one of the kind of misconceptions that I think was embedded in the way you presented this. You said the selfish gene theory argues that it's what's good for the individual. Well, no. In Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, one of the key forms of, in a way, the place where the term selfish gene is most evocative is in explaining altruism among kin. Okay, what you discover is that yes, an impulse to run into a burning building to save your sisters or your brother could indeed flourish, because even though there's a chance you'll die and it'll be bad for the individual,
right,
it will be good for the gene.
Right.
So the selfishness of the gene can translate into altruism without talking about what happens to the large population, okay?
Right. But now group selection has made a comeback.
Well, that's the claim.
And why isn't that true?
Well, first of all, the evidence this guy cites is that E.O. Wilson, he says, the father of sociobiology, E.O. Wilson, has changed his mind. In the current issue of New Scientist, evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson and Edward O. Wilson effectively end the hegemony of blah, blah, blah. E.O. Wilson has always been a bit of a group selectionist, as all insiders know.
Ah, okay.
It's in the book Sociobiology. Apparently, so that book was even more group selectionist, although he somewhat modified it after getting feedback in the manuscript phase from people like Robert Trivers, who was at Harvard at the time. But
what's wrong with group selection and Wilson being group selectionist, and why are you so against it?
I'm not against it. I'm a little more favorably disposed toward it than I was when I wrote The Moral Animal. But when you hear about the group selection making a comeback, it's usually the case that it's very much like this. What's the why are you saying it made a comeback? Oh, Ed Wilson is for it. Well, Ed Wilson was always for it. You know, it's like that. When you examine the reasons that group selection supposedly has made a comeback, many of them dissolve to essentially nothingness.
How does group selection work? I mean, it does seem to me very similar to the process of cultural evolution you talk about in Non-Zero. Superior societies beat less, inferior societies, and their result, they win. So why isn't a society that's sufficiently organized along collectivist lines where the moose stop reproducing when the order comes down from the top moose, and that society beats out all the other moose societies?
There are a few reasons. I mean, a kind of way to put one of the problems anecdotally. I mean, see, here's the big question, okay? Some group selectionists would like to say that human beings are altruistic in this very diffuse way, in a kind of undiscerning way, you might say, okay?
Right.
An individual selectionist would emphasize, and again, individual selectionist doesn't mean you're saying it's always good for the individual, as I try to explain. Individual selectionists would say, well, there's a kind of relatively diffuse altruism within the family, and then there's all kinds of altruism that can evolve, like toward friends and so on. All the feelings of altruism you feel toward friends could evolve through, they would say, individual selection. Even feelings of sympathy toward someone you don't know who is in distress can be explained through individual selection, they would say,
right.
Okay. Then the group select, but some of the group selectionists would like to say, there are more diffuse still forms of altruism, could evolve, not just directed toward friends, and not just a one-time overture toward somebody who may be in need, but, in other words, a lot of group selectionists would say, we're nicer than the individual selectionists think we are. Now, that is a consequential debate, okay? And that's interesting.
Okay.
But first, I want to say that if you look at the things that, like, David Sloan Wilson, the most kind of prominent of the group selectionists, argue, a lot of times they're not arguing that. What they're doing is they're saying things like, kin selection shouldn't be called individual selection. It should be called group selection. Kin selection is the intra-family altruism,
right,
I just described. Well, fine, call it group selection, but that's not a consequential... And actually, you can make a case for that, okay? You can make a case,
right,
that group selection's a better label. Fine. But that does not make a different prediction about human nature. David also says, well, reciprocal altruism is really group selection. Okay, fine, call it that. But again, what the kind of altruism that would follow from reciprocal altruism remains the same, whatever you call it. Okay, so,
so, So the political implication is how nice we are.
Right. And so to a large extent, what's really going on in the argument does not bear on that implication, okay?
But there are
some meaningful arguments going on, and there are some findings and kind of game theoretical experiments, experimental economics, that I would say maybe more plausibly explained by group selection. There's a tangent I didn't finish, I just realized,
okay.
But never mind. You were asking why is it implausible. I mean, we can do a part two on this if commenters right. find any of this stuff interesting. I'm guessing they've all bailed out, but we can only do so much today.
The political implication is there's this liberal idea that human beings are naturally nice, and if only, you know, people have to be taught to be racist and evil, and if only we let, you know, people be people,
right.
that the sort of good, that their good natural nature, human nature, Rousseauian human nature will come forward, and the non-group selectionists say, no, actually, human nature is actually pretty nasty, and we need some sort of firm social constraints to keep it in place.
Well,
so that's
well,
the argument, right?
Well, that's this guy's assumption. This guy's kind of naive. I mean, first of all, this guy, I'm sorry, but...
No, it sounds like that is the debate.
No, it's not exactly. I mean, first of all, he's confused at the level of thinking the term selfish gene is meant literally.
Okay,
as I said, the point of the selfish gene is that selfishness at the genetic level can translate into altruism even for an individual selectionist, okay?
I came away from your book thinking, gee, there is a human nature and it's really pretty nasty.
Well, you know, I'm cynical and I maybe emphasized it was probably a more cynical interpretation than it completely had to be. But let me say, I mean, if people want to hear more of this, I cannot talk about it too much so far as I'm concerned. But I kind of doubt they do, and we need to wrap it up before long. Let me just make a final point, the irony that this is a confusion in, I think, three senses, that group selectionism is left-wing and individual selectionism is right-wing. First of all, as I said, most of the arguments that David Sloan Wilson has spent his time having do not bear on, are not meaningful in the sense that they do not have any implications for human nature at all. He wants to relabel things as group selection where the relabeling doesn't affect the ensuing human nature. In fact, while I was researching The Moral Animal, I said to him once, can you think of a single example, a single human psychological trait that is accounted for by group selection that can't be accounted for by individual selection? And he said, oh, I'll have to think about that.
Well, but if there were such traits, that would be a left-wing implication, no?
Well, let me proceed. Okay. First of all, as Richard Alexander pointed out, the flip side of what did he say it of within group amity is between group enmity. If you look at the dynamics that would supposedly give rise to altruism in the group selectionist account, it would be it might be conducive to a certain amount of communal living within the society, but it would probably be equally conducive to a strong bent toward warfare among societies. Okay, so it's kind of a net. You know, I mean,
yeah, good point.
So it's a valid analytical point. So no, on balance, I would not say it's left wing.
Right.
Third, as an historical matter, this is the interesting thing. Group selectionism, as a sociological matter within science, is what has been associated with right-wing scientists, okay? And in fact, and part of the logic was, well, it facilitated social Darwinism by facilitating the kind of naturalistic fallacy, that is to say, infer ought from is, to say, well, if we have an inclination, you know, to kill people, to kill large groups of people, or to cheat on our wives, or whatever, that must be a good thing, okay? That's the naturalistic fallacy. And group selectionism facilitated that by saying, well, evolved human nature is what's good for the group. So we should accept it as a guide because it evolved for the good of the group. Okay, so it actually was, to the extent that it had an ideological orientation going into the 60s, was more right than left. And in fact, the guy who spearheaded the drive against it, individual selectionism, for individual selectionism, George Williams in the book Adaptation and Natural Selection, is on the left. And that may have been part of his motivation, I don't know. But as a sociological matter, it is not the fact that individual selectionism has been on the right. And if people want to hear more, they can. We're already at a
okay. That's enough of a lesson for me today.
for this year, probably.
I'm throwing out my copy of The Moral Animal.
Okay.
You've evolved from it.
Are you doing it on camera in a way that people can see the cover?
I am.
Okay, good. But no, there are a few findings in experimental economics that are suggestive that maybe group selection played a larger role than we thought. A possibility I left open in The Moral Animal.
No, it's still a great book, Bob. If sadly consigned to a brief period of time.
Hey, it's still selling, man.
Okay. So you wanted to move on to your nurturing this flock of commentators.
Yeah. Quickly.
Yeah.
First of all, in the redesign, the forum is going to change. It will be a different forum. It won't be PHORUM, this free kind of software we're using. It will be something called vBulletin.
Okay.
We're hoping that won't cause too much dislocation to commenters.
Right.
We're pretty darn sure we can make the migration of the data, the registration data, happen automatically. We are hopeful that we can actually make all the archival comments happen so that you don't have to switch systems to read archival comments. But we haven't figured out exactly whether there may need to be a brief period when it's kind of hard to make a comment. but
you say you're switching from the free software. You're not saying that people are going to have to pay to make comments.
No. I'm sorry. Yeah. We had to pay a little bit for vBulletin.
For the software. Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay. And then we'll talk about the redesign more someday.
Okay.
Any day now. I firmly predict, Mickey, that you and I will not be seen in this green again.
Okay. Well.
Pretty firmly.
That's your prediction. My prediction is there'll be a scandal. Your prediction is no green.
Okay, I want to complain. I noticed YouTube, one of the pioneering Blogging Heads trailers that Nate did for us has been removed over copyright issues. And I mean, maybe I should vent more on this next time and turn it into a whole discussion of how kind of criminally fair use is being interpreted. Because it just shouldn't happen. It just shouldn't happen.
Who sued? Who got mad?
Well, I think he had movie clips or something, or I don't know. Yeah. It's a travesty. It's a tragedy. And maybe we should just post it on our site and, like, dare them to sue us.
Because you need the publicity.
Mickey.
All right.
Over principle.
Hey, you haven't started a bogus argument that last 4 minutes that you could, like, post to the New York Times site. That's what I was worried about when we went to the New York Times. There was this tendency to try to come up with cute little, easily encapsulated arguments, and that hasn't happened. We've had a totally languid.
I forgot.
A totally
we need
languid
one.
Dialogue.
We need a New York Times argument, Mickey. Wait a second. Oh, I know what'll start one. One of our commenters. I thought this was really well put. You know, it was. You had dissed the word dialogue, and some viewers came to its defense. And B.J. Keefe, in the course of this argument, denounced you and said, and referred to the fact that you often seem disdainful of the comments section. And he says about you, what do you make of a guy that is disdainful of the vast garden of thought that is the BHTV forum, yet respects Ann Coulter?
I'm not disdainful of the comment section. I like the comment section. I value the comment section. We have a good comment section, and good comment sections are hard to come by. I disdain your blatant sycophancy toward the comment section.
Not true.
And devoting large segments of our dialogue, you and me, Bob, to sucking up to these commenters. Let them comment on what we have to say. But what we have to say shouldn't be talking about them. Never mind. Interaction. We're all for interaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, what do you know, man? That's what I would say.
But
what
dialogue
do you know?
Is still a terrible word. It's just hard to pronounce.
Okay. Remember Conservative Commenter Appreciation Day?
Yes.
Somebody listed the known conservative commenters who were fairly prolific posters. Garbage Cowboy, Pacivorous, Denville Steve, now known as Steve R for reasons. Okay, any user for reasons we don't know. Liberace, Hans Gruber, Petty Bourgeois, Frustrated Patriot, and then thus Sprock Elvis spoke up. Or no, now he's called No, but he changed his name from thus Sprock Elvis for reasons I don't understand, because that's one of the great all-time usernames. A reference to Nietzsche, Mickey, in case, or is it Nietzsche? I get him mixed up with Ray Nitzky, formerly the Green Bay Packers. But, and I would just say, I mean, I'd
Jack
appreciate
Nietzsche, the inventor of the Nietzsche phone.
What?
There was a musician named Jack Nietzsche who played with the Rolling Stones.
That's your bailiwick,
very,
man.
Very, very important. Anyway, go ahead.
I would say, isn't Simon Willard, doesn't he belong on that list, or am I confused?
Well, I don't know, but it's a stupid characterization, because some of the left-wingers who post on Daily Kos actually have conservative instincts on some issues. I think.
Well, speaking of that,
isn't there
one guy says, defines himself as a left, this is Threep, as a left libertarianish hawk, which I maintain, certainly left libertarian hawk, I would say there's no such thing. You know why?
Because if you're a true libertarian, you don't believe in the massive state required to wage war.
No. I think you can be a libertarian hawk, like Glenn Reynolds. I just mean you can't say you're on the left then. Because libertarians, I mean, they're ideologically ambiguous because, you know, fiscal issues, economics, domestic policy, right? Social issues left. So there, it's like a balance. And what swings the balance is foreign policy. And if you're hawk, then it's two out of three, you know,
why
makes
you
right
wing.
Why can't
you say, I believe in smut and permissiveness, and we're fighting a war to bring smut and permissiveness to Iraq?
You know, actually, in some ways we are, but...
Well, then you're a left libertarian hawk.
I guess if that is...
I mean, you'd be an idiot, but you're a left libertarian hawk.
Another interesting contribution. So anyway, I'm curious what the definitive list would be of conservative commenters, and also this Exus 99 guy who torments me increasingly, or gal, presumably, is on the right. Okay, enough about that. Somebody said I should quit celebrating people when they arrive at the 1,000 comment list because it rewards quantity, not quality.
Good point.
Okay, so maybe I will. I'll think about it. Maybe that's a good idea. Certainly, we should reward quality more systematically. And this guy Dell.
Actually, the web itself, the economics of the web reward quantity over quality. Because you want massive number of hits, and the more hits, the better. It doesn't matter how.
So we will be a countervailing force by rewarding quality.
Okay, that's why you're...
This New York Times piece about how the evangelical, you know, political bloc is breaking up. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
A few weeks ago. It was discussed on one of our Dia vlogs, and I was kind of skeptical of it at first. I mean, it seemed too good to be true. I'd love to think it's true, and all of a sudden parts of the evangelical bloc that were on the right are drifting left.
Right.
And he just did this rigorous analysis, showing, I mean, Dell is usually a guy's name, I'm assuming it's a guy, you know, of course, I mean, Bush's supporters, of course, dropped among everybody, but less among evangelicals, and so that the upshot is that it, being a white evangelical is actually a stronger predictor of support for Bush than it was in 2001. I mean, that's a subtle, significant point.
I guess, if huge blocks of the evangelical movement are becoming, you know, global warming fanatics and ecologists and are drifting left, you know, if that takes away 20% of the evangelical movement, that's important regardless of what this guy's, the tendency of, you know, the rest of the...
Well, if it's the case, but you see, I mean, if it's the case that parts of the evangelical bloc that were these big Bush supporters have been lured into the Democratic Party by global warming, I'm just very skeptical.
Well, Huckabee's the Trojan horse here because he's a hardcore evangelical, yet he's a wimpy liberal on a host of issues, and he's going to lead the evangelical movement toward the left within the Republican Party.
That's an interesting point. That he his success in the general might be premised on the kind of New York Times magazine thesis being true, right? Or no?
He would bring it about.
Well, it's interesting that he could be a pivotal figure in conceivably in the future of the evangelical movement. Another significant guy is the guy who wrote A Purpose-Driven Life. What's his name? Dan something or what?
I don't know.
Largest selling book in the history of the universe.
Warren? I think his name is Warren.
Rick Warren.
Yeah.
Yes. He's interesting on this.
He has a big church that Hillary just spoke at, I think.
Yeah. I actually met him briefly. And I mean not to name drop, but like Al Gore was there. And they were on good terms. But my question, what I would like to see for, of course, predictable reasons is, well, he seems like the kind of guy who has the potential to go a little left on foreign policy. And that's the move I'm waiting for among some evangelicals.
You're also waiting for him to be tough on Israel. I think you're going to be waiting a long time for that one.
Actually, that's not high on my list with Rick Warren.
Okay. The problem for you with this dialogue, Bob, is we have the bogus 4-minute New York Times confrontation. We did have one.
What was it?
But it was about the Huma rumor, and that's exactly the one the New York Times won't want to run.
Oh, man.
So you're in deep trouble.
Shoot. Anyway. Well, got to close with Dingle Ink of the Week.
Okay.
Joel Cairo. This one was good. He caught Jonah Goldberg in a moment where, as he denounced compassionate conservatism, he squashed a bug. Some sort of flying insect. He captured it and executed it on camera while taking a stance against compassion. I mean, how good is that?
This is Jonah?
Yeah.
Man, I always thought he was talented.
He's amazing. And what a Dingle-Ink catch. So Dingle-Ink of the Week, what did we say we were going to give to people who won the coveted Dingle-Ink of the Week award?
I think a weekend at your house.
I thought it was sexual favors from you, but maybe I'm wrong.
It was one of ours book, I think.
I think it was your book.
I don't think it was my book.
It was your book. So Joel should email us with his address, and you will send him...
I should actually be happy to do that, right? Because I want as many readers as possible.
Totally. No, yeah. We will send him a book by one of us.
Okay, cool. Send me the address.
If Joel Cairo emails, like, whatever it is on the site, feedback@, with his address, he'll get, like, a book.
Cool.
And that's just for one Dingle Ink of the Week.
Man, what a deal.
I mean, no wonder we're not making money, Mickey. We're just giving stuff away.
Well, that and your plan to reward quality, not quantity. See how that flies?
That too.
See how that one flies with your investors.
Yeah, and our corporate integrity.
And your advertisers. We have three hits, but they're really good hits.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well.
We're awaiting Web 3.0.
Where we eliminate interaction entirely and just pipe propaganda directly into your brain.
No, I was thinking, okay, that would work. Okay, longest dialogue in history, right?
Absolutely.
Way to go.
See you later.
See ya.